Well, hello everybody. It's nice to see old friends and familiar faces, and also to see, I guess you're all in the front row, are you, the students? Because I think I'm supposed to be talking mainly to you. That's why you're in the front row. And fortunately for me, you will never have heard me speak before, so it'll all be completely new, I hope. Unfortunately for some of you, you'll have heard me speak before, and you'll be hearing things that you've heard before, because really I only have one thing to say, one idea, and you'll get the point, I think, as we go along. And I think you've been doing it on this course for the last 6 months anyway. It's a very good idea, so we'll get on with it. Am I in the picture? Because I want everybody on the camera to see my tie. I don't normally wear a tie when I talk at Chisholm, but today I've decided to wear a black tie. It's not in memory of anyone human. It's not in mourning for anyone. It's a tie I was given by Ida here, who you're going to meet in a minute again, vocally, because she's going to read something to you. She brought it back from Iran. It's interesting to get a tie from Iran, where the tie is the sort of stigmatized icon of Western imperialism. But here it is, a Persian tie with Farsi on it. And in fact, it's a verse of Molavi, of Rumi, Mevlana, as you call him in Turkey. So I'm going to be talking about that. You see the title of my talk, The Vision of Rumi, The Perspective of the Eye of the Heart. So this is really a kind of long commercial for my new book. Not really. I haven't written it yet. I'm writing it. It's like that cartoon Peter Cook once did, two men standing outside at a cocktail party, and one says to the other, "I'm writing a book," and the other one says, "So am I." Nor am I. Now, I am writing this book, and it's nearly there. So, right, let's get on with it then. What it says on my tie is Morde bare malakutam niam az aleme khak do se ruzi qafasi sakhte and az badanam. I am the bird of heaven. I am not of the world of dust. For several days they've made a cage out of my body. This comes from a ghazal which begins, every day my thoughts are this and every night my words. Why am I negligent of the states of my own heart? And then he goes on, where have I come from? What was the purpose of my coming? Where am I going to in the end if you won't show me my homeland? And then we get this verse later on, I am the bird of heaven. I am not of the world of dust. For several days they've made a cage out of my body. It's a wonderful verse. It's a wonderful ghazal. Ghazals are short lyric poems. They last about 5 minutes to read. You're going to hear one in its entirety in a minute, which only takes 1 minute. And these are kind of, they're performances in the moment. They are a realization. This is the wonderful thing about poetry, is that you can actualize something that Rumi said or would have delivered, 800 years ago, 750 years ago. Here you have it in the room. We hear it in Persian, and you're actualizing a state of mind, and it's a little jewel that is preserved. In fact, not one, but there are thousands of these jewels in these two volumes of the Divan of Shamsi Tabriz. You've perhaps heard of the Divan of Shamsi Tabriz, dedicated to his teacher or to his soulmate and mentor, Shamsuddin of Tabriz. So this is where I'm starting the talk, and really this is my one idea, and all my talks are about this idea, which is that whatever we think we are, we're not that. We are the bird of heaven. We are not of this world of dust, but for several days we occupy this cage, which is the body. And I heard you, I went down to the car last night to get something, and I passed the meditation room, and I heard all the birds in this room calling out, Allah, 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 20,000 times. And I thought, they're twittering to God. They're tweeting. They are saying the word. They're calling upon the Lord. So this is, I found it interesting to listen. I just stood there for a few minutes listening, and I heard that this is an ascent. Stephen was talking yesterday about an ascent. You are in ascent when you're in ascension, when you're doing that. And that release from the cage of the body is going on. And so it should be Allah, Allah, Allah. It's an upward movement, isn't it? Rather than a sort of earthbound sound. It's a heavenly, heavenbound sound. Okay, so let's get on. I'm going to talk about the vision of Rumi. I'm going to talk a lot in metaphors, because poetry is all couched in metaphors. I do a lot of translation. Translation is the same word as metaphor. It's the Latin form of the Greek word metaphor, meaning to put across, to transfer, to translate from one context to another. Metaphor is something we get used to, we have to get used to in mystical texts, because we cannot speak about the unseen, we cannot speak literally about the ineffable. So I begin by saying that my current work is to try to make a doorway for this and the next generation to gain access to one of the greatest texts ever written. At the moment, that text is rather closed to all but the most determined of readers. I mean the Masnavi-e Ma'navi of Jalaluddin Rumi, we call Maulana, Mevlana. Here is the text of the first volume of the Masnavi in a recent edition, not Nicholson's edition of Estet Lami, published in Tehran, still available in Tehran. Very much a current work, not a medieval work, a work that still is alive today and published today. Nicholson's 1930s English prose translation was written in deliberately archaic English, as was the fashion in the 19th and early 20th centuries, out of a curious form of respect for sacred texts, which goes back to the King James Version of the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer, which we know was itself archaic in its own day, and certainly by the 19th century, this language is almost impenetrable. By the 21st century, it's difficult. Nicholson is full of what someone recently told me he thought was the these and thous and warts and wasts I can't be dealing with. I kind of agree. To young people, this is even, to new readers, this is even more off-putting. So this is the first barrier to overcome, for me to try to provide a good, fluent, modern translation that reflects the musicality of the original. And one mustn't try to turn it into doggerel or in any way do violence to its poetic beauty. I'm going to ask Ida to read some Persian in a minute. But in Persian, the language of the Masnavi and the language of the Ghazals is rich, but it's not problematic in terms of its lexicon and its syntax, its vocabulary and its structure. The main barrier for the translator is the difficulty of understanding its sublime nature and of understanding the metaphors that Rumi speaks in so easily, so naturally. I've often found myself understanding every single word, but not at all understand what Rumi means. It may be because it's beyond my understanding, and you have to sit with these metaphors and let them seep in to yourself. Well, this book that I'm writing, I have a favour to ask of the reader, and I have a favour to ask of you today as listeners, and it's one that's not often asked by academics, and that is to be prepared to follow the logic of my argument through very frequent citation from the text of the work, of the Masnavi and of the Divan. This is an unusual request, as authors are normally expected to make their arguments abstractly, as if objectively from a place detached from the material. But Rumi's Masnavi and the Divan are not normal texts, and I've found that in order to explain the subject, I prefer to quote Rumi's own words. Someone asked me a few months ago, not an academic, but someone who thinks of herself as a Sufi, she asked me, what was I writing about in this new book? And I said, the vision of Rumi, and I started to explain. And she grew impatient and said, "So, it's your theory of what he was saying, is it?" Now, I suppose she was right, but there was something I felt was being misunderstood, as my book's not intended to be a new theory about the Masnavi, remaining on the academic periphery, so to speak, serving up a new theory and putting it into literary critical terms or philosophical perspectives. What I'm specifically not trying to theorize or put the Masnavi into perspective or context. Rather, I'm trying to enable the reader to enter the Dar-e Masnavi, the house of the Masnavi, and see for themselves. So I'm trying to be just the doorman. The quotations are integral then to the argument, not just illustrative or ornamental. They are my argument, or they're Rumi's argument. One of the reasons for writing like this, that is with the Masnavi in mind rather than about it as a subject, is that though the Masnavi is a great long poem, it's often been read in the modern West and by westernized Iranian and other Muslim scholars as a philosophical treatise. It's not just, of course, a literary poem, and it's wrong to have this dichotomy between mystical wisdom and literary poem. It is a work of literary genius, but it is a didactic and explanatory, pedagogical, instructional text. And by the act of reading it, you are performing it. And by the act of performing it, you are entering into it. Its method is enchantment, not discursive treatise. The sounds, cadences, and rhythms, melodies, and harmonies are evocative in Persian, and those are more or less lost to non-Persian speakers. But they are accessible in good translations, I hope. I don't believe in Robert Frost's statement that poetry is what gets lost in translation. I put it the other way around, that in translation we may discover poetry. So it is a poetry that is enchanting and that seduces the mind into a state of openness and then works on the imagination. And I described this in a lecture I gave here a few years ago. You mentioned it. It was called Open Heart Surgery. And it's on the website, I think. I haven't dared to listen to it again, but I'm going to mention some of those ideas here again today. And it's being published in a new book by Leonard Lewison called The Philosophy of Ecstasy, being published by Taurus this year. But my work isn't to add to Rumi's evocation or to celebrate it even, but to enable the reader, separated by the distance of since the 13th century, to see what's evoked. Now, the art historian and writer John Berger said about stories, he says, "Remember what it was like being sung to sleep. If you're fortunate, the memory will be more recent than childhood. The repeated lines of words and music are like paths. These paths are circular, and the rings they make are linked together like those of a chain. You walk along the paths and are led by them in circles which lead from one to the other, further and further away. The field upon which you walk and upon which the chain is laid is the song, or in this case, the gong." Thank you. Now, Rumi's song is one that enchants the listener to go where she never dreamed, to imagine what previously she might never have imagined. So I'm going to ask Ida to read one of these very short ghazals from the beginning of the Divan, just to give you an idea of this one simple idea, and that is that a poem like this, and actually a poem like this great long Masnavi, is not an intellectual idea, but is an experience, a hal, if you like, or it is a journey, a movement, which is caught in language, which is frozen in time, if you like, but is there to be performed the next time you open the book or the next time you hear it. And not just performed, but received. There's a performance and a reception. Now, I'm not going to tell you what this is about, except that it's an ecstatic calling of the speaker upon God, not addressed as God, but by many other metaphors. But you'll hear the repeated word ma, which means hour. And that hour is representative of the relationship that is being established in the act of calling. So, Ida, please, in your own time, just read it. It's just 5 verses long.
ای یوسف خوشنام ما، خوش می روی بر بام ما، ای در شکست جام ما، ای بردرید دام ما، ای نور ما، ای سور ما، ای دولت منصور ما، جوشی بنه در شور ما، تا می شود انگور ما، ای دلبر و مقصود ما، ای قبله و معبود ما، آتش زدی در عود ما، نظاره کن در دود ما، ای یار ما، ای یار ما، دام دل خمار ما، پا وا مکش از کار ما، بستنگر دستار ما، در گل بمانده پای دل، جان می دهم چه جای دل، و از آتش صدای دل، ای وای دل، ای وای ما.
In that last line he says, the foot of my heart is stuck in the mud. But he's offering himself up to escape that being entrapped. Right. In the Christian Gospel according to St. Mark, chapter 9, verse 47, it is a Sunday morning after all, we have the striking words attributed to Jesus, and if your eye leads you into evil, pluck it out. Rumi has a similar idea in the third ghazal of his Divan, the one just before this one. He says, and it's on the screen, گفت ار دو چشمم عاقبت خواهند دیدن آن صفت هر جزو من چشمی شود که غم خورد من از غما و عاقبت این چشم من محروم خواهد ماندن تا کور گردد آن بصر کو نیست لایق دوست را. He said, if my two eyes at last shall see that way, my every part become an eye, why grieve for blindness? But if at last this eye of mine remain deprived, let sight that is unworthy of the friend be blind. Blindness and sight, light and darkness, make up a powerful analogy or metaphor of understanding, especially mystical understanding across cultures. For Rumi, lack of sight is illusion and delusion. Vision is the power of sight. He means, of course, seeing in the spiritual sense, and the illusion is that we confuse form and meaning. We confuse appearance and reality. We see permanence and solidity in physical things as certainties. We assume that invisible things, meanings and values, what we call spiritual realities, are insubstantial, transitory and imaginary, unstable uncertainties. In the normal human condition, confusion arises from being misled by our perception of sensual phenomena as the real when they are an illusion. Yet, and this is the curious and perplexing thing that Rumi demonstrates very clearly, at the same time, illusion signifies the reality from which it is derived. But this can only be appreciated if it is understood. Indeed, if it is seen that phenomena are merely the multifarious signs, ayat, of the unseen. Here's a passage from the first book of the Masnavi. What comes of qualities and names? The word, here we are, as sifat wa nom, from, you say sifat in Arabic. What comes of qualities and names? Illusion. Yet that illusion signifies the union. Have you seen signs without a signifier? When there's no road, there is no ghost to haunt it. And have you seen a name without its essence? From R-O-S-E, have you picked a rose? You've named it. Now go find the thing you've named. The moon is in the sky, not in the river. If you would pass beyond the name and letter, then cleanse yourself of self once and for all. This sounds almost like the semiotics of Roland Barthes, who says that the sign needs the signifier. But here, Rumi is urging the reader to find the meaning or signification, but not to mythologize it by identifying it absolutely as a form, as a second-order signifier, Barthes would say. Enough of that. It's an open-ended signification, ultimately signifying the divine in manifestation. In plain language, we recognize illusion when we know it to be illusion instead of reality. And then we can see what is not there but is implied in the manifestation. Just to give you an example, I think of the cardboard cutout uniformed policeman in the window of motorway service stations. You're momentarily fooled by the illusion of seeing a policeman. But having seen through the illusion, the meaning is nevertheless conveyed. You are being watched. Yet if we were able, we would not see illusion. We would see the truth even through the appearance of illusion. A lot of the Masnavi is devoted to making this kind of seeing through illusion apparent. Illusion of all kinds. And it is a thoroughly Quranic idea. To God belongs the east and the west. Whichever way you turn, there is the face of God. God is omnipresent and all-knowing. Which Rumi turned into poetry in a Rubai, number 247 of the Divan. Wherever I may turn my head, he is the worshipped one. In six directions and beyond, he is the adored one. The garden, rose and nightingale, the ecstasy and beauty, the whole of this is pretext, and all things are of his purpose. Now, I want to talk for a minute about active and passive vision. Vision has several kinds of meaning in English. Obviously, on the one hand, vision is the act and faculty of visual perception, as distinct from hearing, feeling, and smelling, and so on. In vision in the active sense. On the other hand, a vision is something seen in the passive sense, actually or virtually. Maybe a hallucination, with or without hallucinogenic substances. A vision may be an image, imagined or perceived, of a person or a scene of great beauty, sometimes ironically, as in a vision in pink, or a vision may be in the context in which a remarkable person is seen. A dream, an apparition, a religious revelation, such as Ezekiel's vision in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 1, or apparitions of the Virgin Mary throughout the history of Catholicism. The active and the passive forms of vision come together in another sense, which is imaginative perception, foresight, and mystical insight, as in the phrase, a man of vision, a visionary. Now, the vision of Rumi, in the sense that I mean it, includes several of the above senses, but there's one which will be explored above all others, and that is the idea of the corrected faculty of seeing. That the vision of Rumi is something which corrects our cross-eyed vision. From early on in the Masnavi, Rumi utters the enigmatic lines, Eshq khahad kin sohan birun bovad. Love demands that these words shall come out. How can a mirror not be telling all? Do you know why your mirror tells of nothing? That from its face the rust is not removed. That's line 33 to 4 of the Masnavi, at the end of the Nainome, the beginning of the book. The Masnavi is represented as an act of divine love, as love has called it forth. The text reflects this like a mirror, but the mirror of human understanding is obscured by rust. Not much further on in the Masnavi, this is explained as the human condition of being cross-eyed. Ahval, he says, desire and anger make men go cross-eyed, for they distort the spirit from uprightness. When craving comes, then virtue is concealed. 100 veils divide the heart and sight. And I've said this before, I think here, I've asked this question, but those of you who know the Masnavi well, tell me what do you think is the most often referred to common noun after God and man in the text of the Masnavi. And I've said this before, but it may come as a surprise to you that perhaps the two most important, most mentioned words, with nearly 1,200 instances each across the book, is the word I and the word heart, the word chash or ein, and the word, and various synonyms, and the word heart, del, kalb, and various other similes. That's nearly twice as many occurrences as the word for love and its varieties in the Masnavi. So I think I'm right in saying that the Masnavi is, of course, it's about God and man, but it's about the vision and the heart. Perhaps humanity doesn't suffer from a lack of love, divine love, but from a lack of vision and perception of that love, to see it when it's there. So the Masnavi is literally a sight for sore eyes, as he says. There is so much defective in our sight. Give up your vision for the sight of God, his vision for our vision. Fair exchange, and in his vision gain all that you crave. This vision is pursued throughout the Masnavi as the spiritual blindness of humankind is a chosen, not a natural condition, and one that is curable. Sight, that is not physical sight of the eye, but insight, if you like, is intrinsic to human nature, but is masked by human contrivance. He says, you have wrapped clothing round your head and face. No wonder you are blind, though you have sight, for man is sight, and all the rest is skin. His sight is that he has the friend in sight. Without the friend in sight, sight's better blind. The friend who will not stay is better gone. The friend, of course, is the Persian word dost, yar, which means the divine beloved, whose mysterious proximity to our existence is the whole subject of the Masnavi and the relationship between the human being and the divine friend. This is a mystery that's entered into in the course of the Masnavi as correct vision begins to be made available to the attentive reader. It is therefore a work of literally gradual illumination of the imagination. Central to this process of illumination is the opening of what Rumi calls the chashmidel, the eye of the heart. Ayn al-qalb, I suppose it would be in Arabic. The operation of the mystical heart surgeon, then, is different from that of the cardiologist of the medical operating theatre. Rumi's spiritual physician uncovers the veils that obscure the heart. He's not working to unblock clogged ventricles and arteries, but rather to restore the sight of the heart, the clarity of the heart, to remove the rust from the mirror. You remember that story of Rumi and the caliph and the ambassador of Rum, when Caesar's ambassador couldn't see the caliph's palace. O brother, how will you perceive his palace when hair has overgrown your inner eye? Your heart's eye must be cleansed of hair and error. Then go and have a look and see his palace. What causes the blindness of the heart's eye is variously described. In one passage, Solomon is said to have achieved perfect vision by emptying his heart of all that cluttered it, namely the kingdom of the world. Since Solomon had cleansed his heart of wealth and power, he'd only called himself the poor. A stoppered jar in troubled waters even can float on water with its air-filled heart. So when the air of poverty is within us, there's peace upon the waters of this world. Although this whole world is his sovereign kingdom, this kingdom is as nothing to his heart's eye. The reason for the connection between the eye and the heart is expressed in one highly contracted verse. This was one of the most difficult verses I've ever had to put into English, and it's right fairly early on in the Masnavi. He says in Persian, Nur-e-nur, you know, nur is light. Nur-e-nur-e-chashm-chod, nur-e-delast. Nur-e-chashm-as nur-e-del-ho-ho-selast. Your own heart's light's light is the light of hearts. The eye's light is the outcome of the heart's light. And then this contrasts wonderfully with a verse 22,000 couplets later at the end of the book in the sixth book. Verse 3317. There you are, right at the end of the Masnavi. He says, Jesm, sawye sawye ye sawye delast. Jesm ke ander khure paye ye delast. The body is the heart's shadow's shadow's shadow. How is the body worthy of the heart? There's a kind of symmetry here, which is a bit scary. A scary symmetry. In book one, the next similarly contracted verse, if we go back to the previous verse, this one here, 1134, the very next verse, 1135, says, Baz, nure nure del nure chodast, ke ze nure aqlo hes pako jodast. The heart's light's light is, after all, God's light. It's pure and far from mental, sensual light. So the light of the eye is illuminated by the light of the heart, which in turn is illuminated by the light of God. This doubly illuminated, the light of the eye is neither the light of the intellect, aql, nor of the sense perception. It is transformed vision. The teaching here is that the perfected human being reflects a sublime light. Now, this subject brings us early on in the book to the interior of both this Masnavi and in a passage towards the end of the Masnavi, when Rumi is reflecting on the very brief but well-known story of the Greek and Chinese painters. Some of you may have read that. In a competition between Greek and Chinese painters, the Sultan assigns to each group one of two adjacent rooms in which to create their masterpieces. The Chinese painters use all their colors to create a magnificent painting. The Greeks use no colors, but merely burnish the walls to a state of ultimate reflectiveness. The Sultan is amazed by the Chinese painting, but when the doors to the Greek painters' rooms are opened, it reflects the Chinese painting even more magnificently. And after that, he went to see the Greeks. They drew the curtain back between the rooms. The image of those pictures and those works reflected on those walls with clarity. And all he'd seen in there was finer here. His eyes were stolen from their very sockets. He compares the Greeks to the Sufis in their freedom from intellectual and artificial technique. As he puts it, instead, they've stripped their hearts and purified them of lust and greed and hate and avarice. The mirror's purity is like the heart's, receiving images beyond all number. The reflection of the divine light is exemplified in Moses, who as a prophet perfectly reflected the infinity of forms. So Rumi goes on to say, this is further on, you see, this is where he's talking about the still relating it to the story, But he goes on to make this point. The endless formless form of the unseen shone from the heart's mirror on Moses' breast. Although that form is not contained in heaven, nor on the throne, nor earth, nor sea, nor Pisces, because they have a boundary and a number, the mirror of the heart is free of limits. The mind is silenced here, or led astray, because the heart's with him, or is himself. No image is eternally reflected as one or many, except within the heart. So the masonry is likened to a mirror, in which one sees reflected myriads of inexpressible things, because it is to the mirror of the heart and soul, not of the reader's face or mind. So it's a mirror, but not a mirror as you know it. As he's beginning the second book of the Masnavi, he reflects on the symbol of the mirror like this. This is just line 93 to 7 in the second book. How shall I look upon my face, I wonder? Is my complexion like the day or night? So long it was I sought my soul's reflection. Nobody ever showed me my reflection. I said, well then, the mirror is for what? That all may know just who and what they are. The iron mirror's for the surfaces of things, that for the soul's face is a precious jewel. The mirror for the soul's none other than that friend's face from those other regions. And the passage then comes to a climax, as the realization occurs in Rumi's voice, and we hope in your mind, when he says, I said, heart, seek the universal mirror. Go to the sea. It comes not in the stream. I mean, you could contemplate that all morning, couldn't you? That one mesra, half line. Go to the sea, it comes not in the stream. Your eye became the vision for my heart, and my blind heart was drowned in vision. I saw you, ever universal mirror. I saw my own reflection in your eye. Now, as you know, none of the above is really about reflections, mirrors, and eyes at all. These are a concatenation of poetic metaphors that is intended to train the reader in the art of discrimination and disentanglement from the self-regarding self, so that one may see from an entirely different point of view. He makes 100 worlds like this appear when he makes your eye see him in himself. The radical adjustment of vision is to see God not from the point of view of the human self, but to see him in himself, as this text puts it. So how does the poet effect the realignment from the supposedly natural perspective of human psychology, where we're caught in the state of selfhood, and where we must ascend to the state of mystical perception? Well, one thing is clear. Rumi doesn't attempt to achieve such a reorientation through the use of rationality, akl. The image of the eye of the heart is one of several bold poetic images intended to subvert the dominance of the theological and philosophical intellect. Located in the being of God, the eye of the heart transcends the universe of created things, while at the same time it locates the transcendent dimension of reality intimately close to human nature. Recalling Quran 50:16, we created man. We know the promptings of his soul and are closer to him than his jugular vein. In the Masnavi and generally in Sufi discourse, there is a reciprocal intimacy between the divine and the human, and the eye is the organ, the interface, if you like, of that intimacy of God with the world. Not the physical eye, but the eye of the heart. This poetry is not didactic in that it's describing and prescribing a transformed psychology theoretically, but rather it's a poetry of ingenious interrogation and provocation that demands a performance from the reader, that works upon the imagination, moving the reader to see differently, or perhaps better, to see for once, instead of remaining blind forever. Now, I just want to spend the rest of the lecture, the talk, talking about some of the ways in which he does this, the ways that he evokes and provokes the listener to see things differently. I think I was going to read that to you, but I think I'm going to skip it. It's too much. Oh no, I like it. I'm going to read it. It's from Masnavi 4. I thought that I would come into the faith to drink some water from this flood of blood. How did I know he'd make a transformation within my nature, make a Nile of me? To my own eye, I am a flowing Nile, but to the eyes of others, I am still. Just as the world is heedlessness to us, yet to the prophet it is plunged in praising. To his eye it is filled with love and bounty, to others' eyes a dead material thing. To his eye vale and hill are swiftly moving, from clay and brick he hears a subtle discourse. All this is limited and dead to vulgar folk. I've seen no vale more wonderful than this. Okay, now we're in the Victoria and Albert Museum. Great texts are like great textiles. This is the Ardabil carpet in the Victoria and Albert Museum. It can be inspected closely, but there is a limit. A limit. You can get close and then you lose focus. With a text, you get close not to the physical manuscript. What you get close to is that you enter into the metaphors. You can get almost infinitely close because the words are virtually imperishable. They are so precious, they can be memorized, and nowadays, with virtuality and digitalization, we can analyze the threads of text remotely and without actually touching, let alone unweaving, the text. Once in a trustworthy edition, the text is safe to inspect without fear of destruction by physical contact or climate conditions, like a carpet. Yet, a text like the Masnavi of Maulavi can be damaged by translators, editors, exegetes, and popularists. We don't cut up, well nowadays we don't, we shouldn't, cut up precious carpets into pieces and sew them together. Moreover, the Masnavi is woven in poetic metaphor and we are beware of unravelling its poetry into philosophy or theology or even theosophy. Metaphors are like, I think of it like this, metaphors are like knots, the knots in a carpet that hold it together. You unravel them, you explain them too literally, and holes start to appear in the poetry and it falls apart. Metaphors are like the thousand eyes in the text, looking into the imagination of the reader and listener. So metaphor is not only a poetic component, it is also its very subject. The myriad phenomena of this created world are each an example or similitude, you know the word, mesl in Persian, of the self-disclosure, tajalli, of haq, the truth. This truth, haq, cannot be spoken or described explicitly, but only in terms of the manifestations in similitudes, amsal in Persian, and imagined only by accessing a world of higher imagination that transcends the material and sensual world. Are you with me? Am I losing anyone? Keep up. The term mesal or mesl, mithl, methal, is not equivalent to the modern Persian literary term for metaphor, estare, majaz, but includes and encompasses metaphor, simile, proverb, example, adage, lesson, analogy. Mesl has the sense of the phenomena of the imagination, not the faculty of imagination, which is khial, but Persian and Arabic mesal, methal are derived from the root mathala, that a form that occurs frequently in the Quran and Hadith to speak about God's manifestations of his creations. Now, this is central to Muslim understanding of the creation and apprehension of what we call reality. At the Annunciation to Mary, the Quran 19:17 says, "We sent our spirit to her, Mary, as an imaginalized form, Fatamathala, as a man without fault." The world is a stream of such imaginalizations coming into and passing out of manifestation. I briefly want to explore this expanded notion of metaphor in the Masnavi and Maulavi's treatment of story, analogy, homily, and all discourse as being entirely metaphorical. Everything is a bridge. All the images are a bridge, as a standing for or bridging to a higher reality which is otherwise ineffable and inconceivable, but which is absolutely necessary. The bridge is necessary as the destinations on either side. This realm of imagination is the bridge between the physical and spiritual worlds known as Barzakh, the isthmus between the two worlds. Maulavi Mevlana draws aside the veil of ineffability by means of, not in spite of, words. And he does so by a range of poetic acts of intensification. Poetic acts of intensification, destabilization, and purification of the imagination. I'll repeat that. Intensification, destabilization, and purification of the imagination. These are the elements of the ecstatic passages that I would list, I would describe to you. The Masnavi is without, as you know, it doesn't have a single framing plot. It's a bit of a tongue twister. The Masnavi doesn't have a single framing plot. Unlike Penguin, who thought that if I only wanted to translate book one, then I should just summarize what happens in the end for the reader. It ain't like that. There is no single plot. It doesn't go anywhere except to God. It comprises some 275 major stories, but it's not a storybook. As a didactic mystical poem, it teaches the way to realization of oneness with Haqq, the reality that is the source of all being and consciousness. But it's not a philosophical teaching either of ontological doctrines and mystical theology. Other Sufis, such as Muhyiddin ibn Arabi, wrote works of this kind. It is from a different tradition, not a superior or inferior, but a different tradition, the poetic tradition of Sufism. As Paul Ricoeur, the philosopher, says in his study of metaphor, The Rule of Metaphor, a book is called, poetry is not oratory. Persuasion is not its aim. Rather, it purges the feelings of pity and fear. Maulavi's poetry is very affecting, intended to work directly on the heart, to remind the reader, listener, of the true self by the process of emotional re-education through the employment of the higher imagination. As William Chittick said in his book, The Sufi Path of Love, which you may have come across, which is a kind of collection of sayings taken from the Masnavi. But he says this in one of his introductory comments. Later on, page 278, he says, "For Rumi, poetical imagery, whose primary function is to stir up love in the listener, has to be fitted and shaped to men's understanding. As far as he's concerned, his poetry was given to him by God. In other words, he does not manufacture or devise his imagery, but he receives it from the world of imagination within which the beloved manifests himself to lovers in imaginal forms." In my introduction to this translation of mine, Spiritual Verses, the Penguin thing, I attempted to introduce not so much the man Mevlana as the way he writes. That's the book. That's the wonderful illustration from the British Library manuscript. It's a Safavid manuscript. It's on the cover. I set out a theory of how the Masnavi works on the listener and reader. It's based on simple principle of intensification. As Mevlana switches from one way of speaking to another, he kind of shifts levels and he takes you with him. He takes the person addressed by the text, who is always to, to. And to is the same in all Indo-European languages. Thou, do, you. He takes the person addressed on a tour through the landscape of the imagination in a process of poetic, I'm going to use Stephen's word, mimesis, poetic mimesis of reality, so that you are taken literally on a journey of the imagination, of the mystical stages of the path, in a re-education of the imagination. It is entirely an act of dhikr, an act of zekr, in that it reminds the reader of the true source and goal. And here's my diagram. You like my diagram? Well, you can see it later. The Masnavi adopts many voices or registers as it progresses, underlying all of which is the authorial voice, which arises at significant points at the beginning and the middle and the sometimes during the unfolding of the text. This is the great poetic voice we have in the Neiname at the beginning of the work. Beshnoine chun shekoyat mikonad as judai ho hekoyat mikonad. Listen to the reed as it complains, telling the story of separation. This is most clearly Rumi's habitual register. But soon he moves into what is to you the more his more familiar voice, that is the voice of hekoyat, of storytelling, dastan. This narrative mode of speaking disarms the intellect immediately. You see, once upon a time, yeki bud yeki nabud, once upon a time, and he disarms you like that. There once was a king, and he had a daughter, and he married the daughter off, and before he's got to the end of the Mesra, you're hooked. It disarms the intellect in putting it into the mythical past familiar from all your childhood stories and folkloric tales. But interesting, Mevlana Mevlana is the most tricky of storytellers, for not only does he subvert familiar stories in an unusual way, sometimes inverting them, he also plays with you as the reader, because just as he engages you, he abruptly deviates from and interrupts his own narratives. Have you noticed that? That he breaks off and leaves you standing there wondering where the story's gone. And as Avi said to me last night, reading Nicholson is like experiencing a sense of being abandoned by your parents gone off. You know, you're reading this nice story of the lion and the beasts, and suddenly Nicholson leaves you standing there in some long, turgid passage of philosophical disquisition, and you can't wait to get back to the lion and the beasts. And that's the experience of many Iranian readers too, is that Rumi has left them, and unless they've been paying attention, they've learnt how to negotiate this text and to follow him, they're lost too. And so they long for, and what's happened is Nicholson and Arbery published filleted versions of the Masnavi, editing out all the passages in between the stories, so that they thought they could put across the meat of the text. In fact, the meat of the text is what has been cut out, because the story was just the narcotic. It was just to put your intellect to sleep, to engage you, so that once the anesthetic of story had gone into your veins and you could relax, he could open up your breast and start operating on your heart. Well, come back to the schema. This is the very first instance of such an interruption where you're abandoned by the storyteller. I know those of you at the back have all heard this before. I do apologize. In former times, there was a king who was the ruler of this world and of the next. It happened that one day the king went riding with all his retinue in search of game. The king espied a slave girl on the highway. The king became a slave boy to that slave girl. His fledgling soul was fluttering in its cage. He paid his money and he bought the slave girl. Now when he'd bought her and he had enjoyed her, by heaven's fate, the slave girl turned to sickness. Next line. A man possessed an ass but had no saddle. He got a saddle. Wolves had got the ass. Another had a pitcher, but no water. He found the water, but he broke the pitcher. Next line. The king called in the doctors all around. The lives of both of us are in your hands. My life is worthless. She is all my life. I'm wounded and in pain. She is my cure. Now imagine you're sitting in a classroom and you've just been looking out the window for a minute. And you look back at the text. Where have you gone? So that's, I know exactly when to turn to the students and say, are you paying attention, everyone? Because he's shaken you off the horse. The two successive single verse analogies in blue and the pit, the saddle and the pitcher make the point metaphorically. And you have to get, this is a way of telling you what a metaphor is. It couldn't be bolder. The context of the individual scenes of the narratives are completely secondary to the overall didactic purpose that Maulvi has here, which is to illustrate that things don't always go according to plan. But the metaphors are much more powerful and memorable ways of saying that. And these are the amsal. These are little illustrations plucked out of the air. You can imagine him standing there and just thinking, a man had a saddle, but he had no ass. A man had an ass, but he had no saddle. He found a saddle, but the wolves got the ass. You know, it's just an everyday experience. You buy a new car and then you prang it. Hell, you know. This is the subversion of narrative time and context that he's just set up in the story. Here's another one, because this book is a process, a steep learning curve of teaching you how to read a mystical text. There was a cruel king among the Jews, a Christian cleansing enemy of Jesus. It was the time of Jesus and his era, for he was Moses' soul and Moses his. That is, Jesus was. It was the time of Jesus and his era, for he was Moses' soul and Moses his. The cross-eyed king, the Jewish king, divided up these two divine companions on the path of God. Next line. A man told his cross-eyed servant, come, go on and get that bottle from the outhouse. The cross-eyed man said, which of those two bottles shall I bring you? Please tell me what you mean. The master said, there aren't two bottles. Go, leave off your squinting. Don't be seeing double. He said, oh, master, don't be so sarcastic. The master said, try breaking one of them. When he broke one, both disappeared from view. Now, in green there, I've got a comment. This is another level of discourse, okay? So we've got a story within a story, but this is a comment by Rumi. A man goes cross-eyed from his lust and anger, back to the sub-story. There was one bottle, two appeared to him. He broke one, and there was no other bottle. Back to comment. Desire and anger make men go cross-eyed, for they distort the spirit from uprightness. When craving comes, then virtue is concealed. 100 veils divide the heart and sight. A judge allows corruption in his heart. How can he know the oppressor from the victim? Now, what do you think that is? That's another analogy, you see. It's a separate story. We're not in the shed anymore, getting a bottle. A judge allows corruption in his heart. How can he know the oppressor from the victim? Then E, back to the original story. The king was so cross-eyed from Jewish hatred that we cry out, oh, mercy, Lord, have mercy. These analogical interruptions illustrate various points, but they also teach us what an analogy is. They teach us to move with him. The spiritual cross-eyedness of the Jewish king who didn't perceive that Moses and Jesus are actually one and the same, and therefore that the Christians were not to be separated from his own people as competitors. The full cycle of a story is not complete until the text has moved out of story and dialogue between characters into homily or moral discourse, and in this case into several spiritual ecstasies. Now all of this is, you know, in my introduction, but the basic idea is that if, you know, moving around, and this is all schematic, this itself is a metaphor, this is not for real, this is a metaphor of how one way of mapping it. But that from the authorial voice, we go into story, we often break into analogies, and then we will go back into stories, hence all this fancy crisscrossing here, because the text actually doesn't work in a smooth circle like this. It's constantly refracting within this mirror. That's what I said, it's a mosaic mirror, the Masnavi. So it's refracting, so you're going back from analogies to stories and back to analogies, and then back to the authorial voice, and sometimes directly into dialogue. analogy, and then into dialogue is another type of register. Dialogue between characters, where Rumi actually sets his Masnavi onto a great stage of your imagination, and he has characters, fictitious characters, prophetic characters, characters from the Quran, characters from Aesop's fables, characters from his contemporary anecdotes and so on. And from these real personages who have these different voices in the story, he goes into a homily, into discourse, which is moral discourse. Then, of course, he slips very easily into his favourite, it would seem to be his favourite. And this is the Rumi we come to love, which is his flying passages, his passages of flight, where he soars. And it is like the experience of zikr, when you're performing zikr, when you let go, and when it is God saying his own name. And in these passages, these are the remarkable passages that are often quoted, where they fly. But always those passages are terminated by a hiatus, by a stop, because it can go too high. It can go out of control. And there is a rigor and a discipline that he imposes on himself. He says, you're getting tired. You're getting tired. And I should stop. I should perform my own hiatus here and stop you, because time moves on. And you're getting tired. Or he says, you won't understand what I'm going to say in the next part of my lecture. You really won't. So we'll go back to the story. And we go back to the story. But once you've got used to this cycle, you become easy with it. You are able to follow it much better because you have a map. So I can say to my students, now, exam question, where are you in the cycle of discourses here, in the cycle of voices? Where are you? And by looking at the language, if it's in the past tense, it's going to be a story, isn't it? If it's in the present tense, it's going to be a reflection. It's going to be part of his homily, or it's going to be part of an ecstasy. If it's in the imperative mood, urging you to do something, or commanding himself, it's very often a spirit in the spiritual voice. Now, these voices don't exist. This is all imaginary. There are no voices in the Masnavi. All I've told you is a fraud. It's all a metaphor of what's really going on. But, you have to say something, don't you? You have to say something. Or you can just shut up. Yes, which is what I will do in a minute. Yes. It's rather apt at this point, isn't it? How much more verbiage, tropes, and metaphors? I want your burning, warm to burning. Inflame a fire of love within the soul. Incinerate all thought and all allusion. In his passages of spiritual ecstasy, the succession of verses is at his most metaphorical, most freely flowing. It's as the liquid boils, and boiling is a very important metaphor of the state of mind, where you're bubbling and overflowing, and you're unstable, and you're dangerous, you're hot. This is all metaphorical, of course. Don't think you're not really hot. It's not hot. It's not about heat. But now you understand metaphor, you can be cool about it. You can be cool about being boiling over. You can see. And so there is a sense of intellectual understanding that accrues with the imaginative understanding. So it is a process of education. This is a poetic mimesis, this verse. Chandas elfaz o esmar o majaz, suz khaham suz ba'an suz saz, atashi az eshq dar jan bar furuz, sar be sar fikr o ibarat besuz. I say it's a poetic mimesis, enactment of the act of zikr, where there is no past, no future, only now. And after a long passage of increasingly ascending verses of praise, glorification, gratitude, his passage will be abruptly terminated as he declares silence, an event I've called here hiatus, as if in that silence the poet and reader abide in one silence, as one, as he says, I've lost it. Deleted it. So it says in, I have to go back. Let's go on a bit. Nah. It says actually, when discourse came thus far, it closed its lips, as when the pen came here, it broke in pieces. Though you are eloquent, seal up your lips, don't breathe a word, and God knows the right path. Well, that's probably the right place to stop, isn't it? That quotation. Because as you can see, I go on and on and on. So there's no point in going on and on and on when you've got the point. So I think I will pause for thought here with you, and thank you very much for paying attention. Mm-hmm.